Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today, the latest information on simple remedies that could help prevent or be a part of a complementary treatment for cancer. Inexpensive and easy to do. Then, what role does fiber play and how does it promote health in your intestine when it's in there? Also, a lot of women in the United States are not insured for health. In fact, it's over 20% of all U.S. women are uninsured, and it's getting worse. So what can these women do to minimize the downside if they're not insured? Also, that gray matter in the brain, which makes up a lot of the brain, the more you have, the more altruistic you are. How does that work? Today, a special original in-depth investigative report in two parts. Part one today, bad to the bone. Fraud is the business plan. By myself and Dr. Nancy Ashley, and we're going to take a look at GlaxoSmithKline. Then we're going to give you a newsmaker update on recent solar flare reports, including one of those X reports that will be hitting the United States tonight or tomorrow. From Matthew Stein, he is an engineer with degrees in mechanical engineering from MIT. He's also a National Merit Scholar, and he's specializing in how to prepare yourself for a solar storm. So we will start this today. We'll give you the tools you need so that when some big ones come, and they are coming, this is not going to be the cataclysmic one today, but they're going to get more regular and they're going to get worse. We'll show you what to do, including even best places to live. As you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. Time and again, I've watched institutions tell us that they are going to help if we give them a check and total trust. They will help overcome some diseases, including the prevention of disease like cancer. Last night while I was working, I have a monitor in front of my desk, and I want to see what the different channels are carrying and how they're covering things. And one had an ad for a cancer center, and they're around the United States. I have a man who has was diagnosed with stage 3 lung cancer and is doing well. But then under it, it said in a different color font and print that you should not expect this to happen to you. Well, that's interesting. Then I thought for myself, well, what would happen if they took 90% of the people that go through their therapies and spend all that money, $100,000 to $200,000, $300,000, what would be the outcome? Well, death is the outcome. So what kind of ad would it be saying, we have all these doctors and nutritionists and nurses. We have a beautiful environment in this hospital. We're going to give you the best radiation and chemotherapy, state-of-the-art stuff, and then you're going to die. Oh, and here are some photographs of the people as they go bald and as they become emaciated and as cachexia, the wasting away, happens. And finally, here they are on the day of their death, glassy-eyed and with all hope gone. But call us, because this is the likely outcome. It just occurred to me, and maybe that's just how my mind works, when I saw that little disclaimer, but don't expect the good outcome. Well, hello, the whole reason you're doing the ad is because you're in the business of making money. If you took away the money incentive and all these institutions just had, community hospitals or nonprofit hospitals and nonprofit hospices, then you could just focus upon how successful are your treatments? In other words, when someone comes to you, how are they 5 years later? And then we'd see the truth of the complete failure of our entire medical paradigm. I was reading some of the work of Bertrand Russell as well as Alex Huxley late last night in preparation for a commentary I'm going to do challenging how science is becoming the final arbiter of all of our realities. And let's face it, the person that controls science controls the interpretation of everything that is based upon science, including medicine, one example of how they've already done this is in the war on cancer, chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. Anything else that could help must be excluded. Anything on AIDS, and the entire war on AIDS is a fraud from top to bottom. They've never had any success, but those people who are long-term survivors outside of that medical model are never given credit. But science then dictates, and the politics of science, the financial inducement of science, and the limitations of the scientific model determine how we're going to look at AIDS. The same is true with pregnancy, where they excluded midwives from delivering babies, even though there was less infection and less death and a higher healthy birth rate when a nurse midwife was engaged in the pregnancy delivery than an obstetrician in a hospital. But they exclude the nurses, nurse midwives. Now they want to exclude nutritionists, life coaches, wellness counselors. So bad is it that in the state of North Carolina, they forbid a person there from offering any information, including free information, over the telephone to their family or friends, unless they were licensed as a dietitian. That's just happened, and I'll give that to you in this discussion I'm going to have about how whoever controls science in the United States controls everything. You're going to control food, because you will be able to say that only genetically engineered food is food that can sustain the world's food supply, and it's safe and effective. Well, who there is going to argue with you if you don't allow any other challenges? Science doesn't allow challenges. And so then you won't have organic. And science says this is the science-based diet, and this is the new eugenics plan. So everywhere you look, we're being told, trust science. And I'm saying, which science? Official science or independent real science? That will be a commentary I'm writing now. I'll give next week. In any case, they have failed miserably about everything on cancer. But here are some things that work, and they really work. So I want you to take note of these, please, if you care about preventing cancer, and so that you can include these within your lifestyle. First up, simple things. Now, this is all based on what we call evidence-based research, meaning there are hundreds of studies in the peer-reviewed literature on these simple things, like baking soda. You heard me right. 1 teaspoon of baking soda and the juice of a couple of oranges and 16 ounces of water with maybe 4 ounces of aloe vera several times a day, and that is one way to alkalize your body. Now, why is that important? Because it's not that cancer cannot grow in an alkaline body. It can, and those who tell you that it can't are wrong. It's like saying, well, cancer can't grow at a high altitude. It's based upon Dr. Warburg, the physiologist who won the Nobel Prize, said, oh, you don't have cancer at high altitude. Yes, you do, but not as much. They'll say, oh, cancer grows in a fermentative medium. True, but it can grow in both. Therefore, the more alkaline you are and the more consistent your alkalinity is, and you have to redo it every single day, the less cancer that you're probable to produce and the less likely it is you're going to suffer from local acidosis pain. Because when you're in acid medium and you become alkaline, it substantially relieves the pain. So you make your body more alkaline and hence not completely, but substantially less likely to manifest cancer, if you have cancer, to have it go further. Now, that's one way to get it alkaline. But also, then, we have to look at what are some things that actually are known to kill cancer cells. And there's an alkaloid called SANG, S-A-N-G, unarianin, U-I-N-A-R-I-N-G. It kills cancer cells, but not healthy cells, and it's used both internally and externally. It's called bloodroot. Now, anyone who knows Native American healing knows that bloodroot has been used for a long period of time. It's also used around the world. We just don't use it in the United States, but we should. Then you have what is called chaga, C-H-A-G-A. That's in the mushroom family. Now, we know about the immune modulating properties and anti-cancer properties of shiitake, maitake, and reishi mushrooms. This is right up there with them. It is very powerful, has strong anti-cancer properties. So it builds the immune system, too. So persons with AIDS-defining illnesses and cancer and immune-related illnesses, chaga mushroom would be terrific. Now, of course, yesterday I mentioned vitamin D. And vitamin D, they're suggesting 800 to 1,000 units. I'm suggesting 2 to 5,000 units would help prevent cancer. It also helps speed up recovery of cancer, which is one of the reasons that if you can get into the sun, put on a bathing suit for about 30 to 45 minutes a day, once or twice a day, making sure you're taking lots of bioflavonoids, 2 or 3,000 milligrams, lots of vitamin C, 2 or 3 or 4,000 milligrams twice a day, then it protects you from the ultraviolet radiation from the sun, but it also promotes anti-cancer properties, vitamin D. Then you have an old remedy. I was very fortunate when I was very young. I was introduced to two women through Johnny Lee McFadden. I believe at the time she was close to 88 years old. She had been the wife of Bernard McFadden. And she said, I have a couple people I want you to meet and who are friends of mine. I said, fine. So we drove up state, and up in Sullivan County, there was an old farmhouse. And in this farmhouse, I met this elderly woman, and she had been the personal assistant to Rife of the Rife microscope, which supposedly had cured cancer in people. Terminal cancers were cured, and other doctors and scientists and cancer oncologists had verified this. And then it all was destroyed. No one knew whatever happened to it. And she pulls out all of these boxes, and she starts showing me slide after slide after slide of before and after. And she had thousands of these. And then she had this book that had frequencies in it. And she said, everyone's always wanting to know, what were the frequencies for the different diseases? And she said, this is the actual copy. This is from him. And I thought, all right, why aren't you doing something with it? And then she told me this rather harrowing story, how everyone associated with Rife was destroyed, the reputations were destroyed, his laboratory was destroyed, and he was, for all intents and purposes, destroyed. She said, so I've just been holding this in case the day comes when a holistic doctor in cancer wants to do something with it. At that time, there really weren't that many holistic doctors. The few who were very limited. They were mainly looking at Laetrile and vitamin B17 and not looking at his work. Never knew what happened to that woman. Years later, she either moved or died, because when I went back up to see if I could bring those slides and those formulas into the institute, because I had a scientist from UCLA who was willing to work with me, he believed he had the formula, and I didn't know whether he did or not. Turns out he didn't. He had the wrong formula. But then the next person that was introduced to me was the woman who had been working for a long period of time. I'm going to guess she was in her 90s on Essiac. And she was the person who had helped more people using the original Essiac, E-S-S-I-A-C-T, the anti-cancer tea that was developed. The original formula was actually an old Canadian native recipe. And that had been used for hundreds of years. I don't know how much it had been modified or changed. I wasn't privy to that original information. But there was a Canadian nurse. She heard about all this, and she began to treat cancer patients, and she had remarkable discoveries. Now, what I didn't know was whether that was the nurse or it was someone work with her, because this was a woman I'm going to guess was in her 80s. And she, too, had all this information and wonderful stories about this. Well, I suggested some doctors I know use Essiac tea to see if it had any benefit. I didn't know if it did or not. And it did, as a part of an overall therapy. So I'm suggesting Essiac tea as a part of an overall formula. Then something as simple as the Dr. Joanna Budwig, B-U-D-W-I-G. She's a German physicist and biochemist. And she came up with a a therapy, I'm going to guess, 40 or 50 years it's been used. She used flaxseed and cottage cheese. I don't see any benefit in the cottage cheese at all, but I know that the flaxseed, of course, has essential fatty acids and lignans, and that is known to reduce tumors and is vital. We also know that hemp oil has cannabinoids, and that helps kill cancer cells, and that should be used. So that's good. And then a lot of people don't understand that about 10 milligrams melatonin taken about 3 hours before retiring has very strong ability, especially in breast cancer, to inhibit breast cancer proliferation. And then, of course, your cruciferous vegetables. That would have to go right up for most people, right at the top of my must-do list. Take your cauliflower, broccoli, broccoli sprouts, kale, mustard family. By the way, that's why I've always said mustard is simply one of nature's most perfect condiments, but it's really good for you. Most people don't just care that it kind of, I guess, disguises the taste or enhances the taste of a hamburger or a hot dog. But use mustard in some of your dishes. Like I make salad dressings using mustard. Then you're doing a lot of good. But the cruciferous vegetables, if you took them every day, and the things I just mentioned, you're doing a lot of good to prevent cancer. And if you have cancer, using combinations of these, or all of them, would even give you an extra benefit. And at the top of that list is cruciferous vegetables every single day. The more you use, the more protection your body gets. And finally, fiber. We need anywhere from 35 to 50 grams a day. We should have both soluble and insoluble fibers. And it protects us against cancer of the colon and cleanses the colon. And fiber actually promotes a beneficial shift in gut bacteria, meaning it leads to a healthier gut. And now we're realizing that fiber ferments in your gut, and that fermentation produces short-chain fatty acids and metabolites that encourage the growth of good bacteria. And that's the latest research out of the University of Illinois. They published a report on this. And when you look at all the metabolic disorders, diabetes is just at the top of the list, and obesity and heart disease, you're looking almost always at people who are toxic, what I call autotoxemia, meaning they've got a substantial amount of toxicity in their intestines. Hence, detoxification and cleansing is crucial to helping anyone with any program. So the bacteria creates good health within the system, and fiber helps get it there. And fibers from blueberries, pomegranates, raspberries, apple skins, artichokes, those are all good. I'm Gary Nall. Now to our special in-depth original investigative report. This white paper is part one. It is posted, both part one and part two. It is called Bad to the Bone. Fraud is the business plan. As many of you know, I've done several documentaries on the subject of what's wrong with medicine, including the drugging of our children, prescription for disaster, death by medicine, and the most recent one, war on health. In all of these, you have to ask if your average physician or your average politician at the state or federal level or your average public health official, scientists, if people saw this information, why wouldn't they demand a shift, a change? To the contrary, not only is nothing changing for the better anywhere in medicine, it's getting worse. Now, my underlying premise for doing this article is simple. If you and I commit any crime or any social indiscretion, if we were to get drunk and be arrested, if we were to engage in some petty larceny, if we had a misdemeanor against us, it would be forever monikered on our reputation. My question is, if you and I are held accountable for everything we do, why is it that all the major corporations, the pharmaceutical industry and Wall Street firms as examples, are never held accountable? No one ever goes to jail, which I believe they should. That would save a lot of suffering because a lot of people would stop committing crimes if they were personally held accountable. Revoking the charters of corporations that commit these crimes. But all they do is pay a fine. The stock value goes up. And these are the very companies that pay thousands and thousands of lobbyists very big paychecks so they in turn can gain access to policymakers and get laws passed. We've seen this with ALEC and hence state laws and federal laws. So I just believe that we're living in gross hypocrisy. That if you commit some egregious crimes, no matter what the final outcome as far as was it a criminal act, and did anyone's reputation get sullied? Was a civil crime, and did a lot of people get hurt? If you're not held accountable, if you have nothing to pay except a fine, then what is the purpose of the whole exercise? It is just a fraud. Let's take a look specifically at GlaxoSmithKline. Now, you would have thought the way the stock price rose on Monday, July 2nd, 2012, that good news had been reported by British company GlaxoSmithKline. Instead of the announcement, the company had agreed to plead guilty to misdemeanor charges and pay a $3 billion criminal settlement to settle the largest case of health care fraud in U.S. history. Now, from my perspective, if you committed the greatest health care fraud in U.S. history, you would be excluded completely from participating in the health care industry because you committed the greatest fraud. People had suffered, injured, died. So whether or not you were smart enough to get those in control to label this a misdemeanor, even though it was a criminal penalty, a criminal settlement, is irrelevant. You shouldn't be allowed into the game. You shouldn't be allowed into the White House. You shouldn't be allowed anywhere. And the media shouldn't speak about you in the future unless it also brings up the crimes you have been found guilty on. In fact, the settlement was previously disclosed by GlaxoSmithKline to its shareholders and was at least $150 million lower than expected. Not only is this a relatively paltry sum for a company which brings in $45 billion a year in revenue, but it essentially allows Glaxo to be absolved of its many crimes and the injuries and deaths resulting from its dangerous pharmaceuticals over the past decade. It used to be that in most cases, a fraud settlement of more than $1 billion would destroy a company's reputation. But as we've reportedly seen over the years, this is just a regular cost of doing business for the pharmaceutical industry. Ultimately, this $3 billion fine is just a line item on Glaxo's balance sheet. The settlement, which breaks the previous record of $2.3 billion set by Pfizer in 2009, is nothing new for GlaxoSmithKline. Now, here's where I think it's important. Do your homework if you're a journalist. Look at the background and see how many other times has this company broken the law. And you would have just had to look at a 2010 report that since 1991, Public Citizen arrived at the same infamous prescription drug User Fee Act. That means that the drug companies, in effect, buy approval from the FDA for their drugs. And Glaxo has had to pay more in fines and settlements to the federal and state governments than any other pharmaceutical company. $4.5 billion. That does not include last week's $3 billion. That's $7.5 billion. Now, how many private suits have they settled? Have no idea of knowing. Those are kept confidential. So what misdeeds and misdemeanors did Glaxo agree to plead guilty to? Well, let's take a look at Avendia. They failed to disclose safety data. They were fined $243 million. Glaxo brought Avendia to market in May 1999 amid great fanfare, and it quickly became the best-selling diabetes drug in the world. There were signs early on that Avendia caused a significant increase in heart attacks. However, those were ignored and denied by the company, and the FDA denied as well. In the settlement, Glaxo was charged with failing to disclose the results of studies between 2001 and 2007 showing the company, its executives, everyone involved with Glaxo at the policymaking level, and its attorneys, all knew that there was an increased risk of heart attack and death from Avendia. Additionally, Avindia has been linked to stroke and hepatotoxicity, bone fractures, and blindness. Nevertheless, because of aggressive marketing, the medical professionals and clients alike, and despite the fact that reports of injury and death were hitting the mainstream media, as of 2007, sales of Avindia topped $1.2 billion as late as 2009. The drug was completely taken off the market in Europe in 2010. Senators Grassley and Baucus tried to get the drug taken off the U.S. market starting in 2008, but they were unsuccessful, despite the fact that the report they issued revealed that Avindia caused 500 unnecessary heart attacks a month in the United States. The FDA held firm in their support of Avindia and GlaxoSmithKline, even in the face of conflict of interest charges in the panel members who voted in favor of it. Currently, the use of Avindia in the United States is restricted to those already using the drug, and it remains available. You heard me right. It remains available. So much for the FDA caring anything at all about you on any level. Then let's take a look at a drug that I believe should be banned. I believe no human being should take this drug under any conditions ever. Paxil. P-A-X-I-L. This is an evil drug. It is bad to the bone. And Wellbutrin. They were found guilty of introducing misbranding and interstate commerce, marketing antidepressants for unapproved uses. They're fined $757 million. That's only about 2 days' profit for this company. Paxil, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor made by Glaxo's predecessor, SmithKline Beecham, was approved for adult depression in 1992. Shortly thereafter, SmithKline started a multi-site study of Paxil for use in adolescent major depression. They had 392 people, which ended in 1997, showed there was no significant difference between Paxil and a placebo in any of the eight pre-specified outcome measures. It showed further that Paxil caused increased risk of suicide, self-harming, mutilating behavior, and harmed others in the adolescents who took it, meaning they would go ballistic. They went postal. They'd hurt people. Even as much as one single dose in certain susceptible individuals. The company, instead of taking any steps to protect consumers, decided to manage the negative results by ignoring unfavorable data and presenting fabricated, meaning lied, falsified, fraudulent material, showing positive results, instead through a ghostwritten article published in 2001 in the prestigious journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. SmithKline Beecham decided this was the best strategy to minimize any potential negative commercial impact, according to an internal document. On the strength of selectively reporting the evidence of Study 329 to the Journal of American Academy of Child and Psychiatric Psychiatry, doctors began prescribing Paxil widely for adolescents, even though the FDA had never approved the drug for this purpose. It wasn't long, however, before the drastic increase in suicides among adolescents taking Paxil became obvious. On June 10, 2003, the British medical authorities took decisive action and banned the use of Paxil in adolescents. Our own FDA, however, was less concerned and added a black box warning advising the risk of suicide in adolescents taking Paxil without banning the drug. Now then you have Wellbutrin. It's an atypical antidepressant approved to treat depression in adults. It was approved by the FDA in 1985. It was taken off the market in 1986 due to increased incidence of seizures in those who used it. But it was reintroduced in 1989 at a lower dose, which seemed to reduce the problem. The government alleged that Glaxo sales representatives and other company officials made great efforts to illegally promote the drug for many other problems, including sexual dysfunction. Glaxo was not charged with failing to warn customers about the increased risk of seizures, hypertension, behavioral changes, aggression, and/or hostility, despite the fact that the adverse effects of this drug are serious, and its use for longer than 6 weeks has never been tested. Civil charges under False Claims Act, a fine of $2 billion, and it was divided into Avindia, $757 million, and the rest for the other. Then you have off-label marketing of Advair, Lamictal, and Zofran. They were fined $1,043,000,000. Glaxo falsely promoted its asthma drug, Advair, for first-line therapy for mild asthma patients, even though it was not approved or medically appropriate under these circumstances. It also promoted Advair for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease with misleading claims as to the relevant treatment guidelines. There were no penalties for the fact that Advair appears to cause breathing problems in those who use it. And then you had other drugs, Lamictal, where it was promoted for off-label, non-covered psychiatric uses. It was used for pain, and yet they didn't have the studies backing these up. Same with Zofran. It was GlaxoSmithKline promoting certain forms of Zofran, approved only for cancer chemotherapy and radiation therapy and post-operative nausea. They were promoting for the treatment of morning sickness in pregnant women. But pregnant women hardly need the possible adverse effects of Zofran: dizziness, stomach pain, blindness, blurred vision, chest pain, irregular heartbeat, and fainting. And the settlement also includes allegations that GlaxoSmithKline paid kickbacks to healthcare professionals to induce them to promote and prescribe these drugs. And the United States alleges that this conduct caused false claims to be submitted to federal health agencies. Now, here's an issue. So they're buying doctors, they're buying scientists, they're paying payola. Any of those people charged? None. Lose their license? No. Anyone indicted for income tax evasion? No. And they were, the price on that was $300 million. And also for price gouging for Medicare. Between 1994 and 2003, GlaxoSmithKline and its corporate predecessors reported false drug prices, which resulted in them underpaying rebates owed under the Medicaid drug rebate program and overcharging the public health service. Okay, so they were putting it to the American taxpayer. They illegally scammed us. Were they excluded from ever participating again or their drugs? Not at all. Pay the fine, get back in line. In addition, GlaxoSmithKline has executed a five-year corporate integrity agreement, but that didn't mean anything because they didn't have to change anything. And so much for telling them, I will not do this again. Oh, yeah, they'll do it again. From 1999 to 2003, GlaxoSmithKline engaged in what the complaint called a nationwide, quote, scheme to promote the sale and use of Wellbutrin, SR, for indications, doses, and populations that the FDA never approved, end quote, and were not even medically indicated. The so-called quality of life issues that include weight loss and improved sexual drive. Former Glaxo's regional vice president of sales, Roger Hawley, is said to have coined a catchphrase that was institutionalized as a tool to promote the drug. Hawley told the drug reps, quote, we need to let physicians know that Wellbutrin is happy, horny, skinny drug, which, of course, it wasn't. All lies. And one of the marketing programs included Operation Hustle. Yes, you heard me right. Operation Hustle, which was a nationwide campaign to promote Wellbutrin SR to treat comorbid conditions not approved by the FDA, such as weight gain, sexual dysfunction, ADHD, which could occur in someone suffering from depression. Glaxo hired public relations firms to create a buzz and drive sales for unapproved use. The company paid $275,000 to Dr. Drew Pinsky over a two-month period to recommend Wellbutrin in settings where it did not appear that he was speaking for GlaxoSmithKline, such as appearance on the David Essel Alive, a Florida-based satellite radio program, and GlaxoSmithKline commissioned a study to demonstrate the weight loss potential of Wellbutrin, which included only 25 participants who were on the drug for a mere 8 weeks. And during preparation of the manuscript for publication, the author, Dr. Kishmore Gaddy of Duke University, was summarily fired for refusing to stop emphasizing certain safety warnings and for refusing to use the drug's trade name. Dr. Gade was then informed by his chairperson at Duke that GlaxoSmithKline would not fund any more of his studies. Ultimately, GlaxoSmithKline used other physicians unaffiliated with the research to promote Dr. Gade's study in the media and the medical community. One of them, Dr. Fujoka, was an endocrinologist who never treated depression, so all of his use of Wellbutrin was completely off-label. Once again, GlaxoSmithKline's efforts paid off big time as sales of Wellbutrin increased 34% based solely on prescriptions for uses other than as an antidepressant. Glaxo was comfortable with the risk of spending a small fortune to persuade doctors to use Wellbutrin off-label and knowing that the government would pay little attention to this, and if they caught him, they'd pay a fine. Now, finally, for today's show, the misdemeanors agreed to by GlaxoSmithKline are, of course, just the tip of the iceberg. They did not admit any wrongdoing in the selling and marketing of Zofran or Lonanex and Flovent and Valtrex and Avendia or Advar products, nor in its pricing practices. Also, GlaxoSmithKline did not face charges for killing 14 Argentinian babies during illegal vaccine trials that were conducted between 2007 and 2008, falsifying parental authorization in Argentina during these trials so that the babies could participate without legitimate parental permission, not informing patients that Paxil is linked to cardiovascular birth defects, failing to warn the public about the dangers of Paxil withdrawal symptoms, which can result in suicide, self-harming acts, or homicide, knowingly selling products made in their plant in Puerto Rico, which were contaminated with bacteria, other pathogens, and filth, producing a swine flu vaccine and selling it in Europe knowing it caused narcolepsy, destroying the career of Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who tried to point out the dangers associated with Glaxo's MMR vaccine, specifically their Erbaid mumps strain, producing a denture cream, Polygrip, which was so heavily laced with zinc that it produced neurological damage in users, failing to warn consumers the risk of Polygrip, failing to warn consumers that their asthma drug, Advair, contains an ingredient which is associated with serious asthma and asthma-related deaths, and firing whistleblowers who tried to bring these problems to the attention of management. In fact, and finally, the CEO of GlaxoSmithKline is Andrew Witty, who since January 2012 has been Sir Andrew Witty, knighted by the Queen of England for his services in the economy and the UK pharmaceutical industry. Why did he receive such a high honor? Because this is exactly the behavior that gets you noticed, praise, and accolades. It seems ironic, but it is quite a fit, deliberately implied situation. Two GlaxoSmithKline executives cited in the complaint are reaping their rewards as well. Jean-Pierre Garnier, CEO from 2008, is chairman of Swiss drug maker Astellion, and Chris Weibacher, former president, is now with Sanofi, Europe's third largest drug company. Do whatever it takes, no matter how much harm you cause to unsuspecting people, no matter how much you corrupt science and medicine, no matter how much you lie about your real motives and the safety and efficacy of your products, no matter how much you bribe the key opinion leaders to further your message, as long as the result is a lot of money for yourself and your company, it makes the Queen look good, and the president and the legislator and the medical professional all look good. It makes us all very proud of ourselves, doesn't it? I'm Gary Knoll. End of part one. Part two on our next program. Back in a moment.
What's the sense in sharing this one and only life? Ending up just another lost and lonely wife. You count up.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. We will be bringing you at least one original, in-depth investigative report about every 4 to 6 weeks on issues that are not getting any attention, and I believe they deserve it. After all, ask someone what's the priority today. It could be paying your mortgage, could be buying medicine, could be trying to dealing with the side effects of medicine that you never knew would be a part of the problem of taking a drug. What if you're taking 2, 4, 10? What if you're a senior citizen taking 14? How do you know that these have been tested for safety and efficacy? You haven't. In our current system, they probably will end up causing you some severe effects. That's why we're doing this. Now, for our next story today, we simply have to look at an announcement that came out yesterday. I'm on several of the watch lists to determine from astrophysicists and others in the field how bad the different solar sunspots are and when the larger ones are going to be coming, which are going to be coming over the next let's say, 8 to 14 months. Those of us who care about such things want to know so we can prepare ourselves and inform the public. Yesterday, a sunspot, AR1520, unleashed an X1.4 class solar flare, and it's due to hit sometime today and tomorrow. And so I wanted to let you know about geomagnetic storms. This just is an alert, and also to give you some insights, what you can start doing now to prepare for the more serious ones likely to come. Helping us on our journey today is Matthew Stein. As I mentioned at the earlier part of the program, he is an engineer with degrees in mechanical engineering from MIT. He is also a National Merit Scholar, and he works in this field. He is the author of When Technology Fails and When Disaster Strikes. Nice to have you back with us, Matthew.
Oh, Gary, always a pleasure to be on your show.
Matthew, we have upwards of 6,000 brand new listeners every single day, and that's about 1.5 million per year. Most of them are in their 20s and 30s, as we're finding out from our Google Analytics, college-educated, mainly listening at home over the Internet when they download the shows off archives. So they may not have heard our earlier programs and read our articles on solar storms or read National Geographic's cover story last month issue on solar storms. And since the media is not touching this, not giving us any context, take a few moments, please, and talk about why this solar storm is the beginning, I believe, of what will be increasing frequency and severity of the storms leading up to what could be some very devastating storms if they get over 20 in magnitude coming when the major movement is there. And then what is it likely to do? What is realistically it likely to do? And then finally, what can people do to help protect themselves and their families if it should happen?
Okay, well, a solar storm is something that happens, you know, happens often. And we've had a pretty big solar storm, an X5.4, in March of 2012. And it was enough to cause, you know, the lights all the way from the North Pole down to Lake Michigan and Chicago area lit up the sky, and they had to restrict flights over the North Pole. But outside of a little bit of communication and high-altitude flight problems and some shielding in the space station, it wasn't very disruptive to our planet. But every now and then, we get hit by really large storms that make the one in March, which is five times the size of the one we have today, four or five times the size of the one that is due to hit, you know, sometime soon in the next day or so. Every now and then we get a pretty big one. Like in 1989, we had about an X15 storm that fried a major power transformer in Quebec, cut out power to 9 million people for something like 6 hours. Also fried a big transformer on the East Coast around, I think, in the vicinity of Three Mile Island. And they were just kind of barely able to keep a cascading power failure from happening in the East Coast, and also did one in the UK. Well, in 2003, we had about an X17 event that caused a cascading failure in Sweden. And what's more important, and it gives us kind of a taste of what can happen in our country, in South Africa, and I haven't been able to find exactly why it caused such a storm of problems in South Africa, but it burned out something like 13 or 14 of the huge power transformers that the grid totally relies on. Now, people say, well, so what? You know, you lose a few transformers, you got a few spares, you throw them in. Well, these transformers are 20 feet tall, they're tens of millions of dollars a piece, and they're like 100 tons each. You have to shut down the freeway to deliver them, and there's a 3-year waiting list to order a single one, and they're all custom made. And so when 13 got fried in South Africa, I mean, you can handle with spares when one or two goes down, but when 13 goes down, the only way they could deal with it is to ration power throughout the country with rolling blackouts. So for the next year, they had rolling blackouts. Now imagine trying to do work when you go to, you know, you're working, and all of a sudden, with no warning, you've got power down for 6 or 8 hours during your day. Your food's rotting in your refrigerators and freezers. You can't run lights in your shopping center. It's pretty tough to do business. Now, let's say historically, how big do these storms get? Well, 1989 was what's called an X-15 storm or so. 1921, we had a major solar storm, somewhere in the order of 4 to 10 times stronger than the 1989 storm. And in 1859, we had one called the Carrington event that went for 2 days that was roughly 50% stronger than the 1921 one. Well, what would happen today? You know, back in those days, there was no massive power grid. There was individually powered cities. In 1859, there was just telegraphs, and it actually induced such currents that telegraph stations caught on fire and telegraph wires and telephone poles burned down in certain places. So if it happened today, you know, let's fast forward, what it would do is it would destroy hundreds, not just like three, like in 1989, or 13 in 2003 in South Africa. It would destroy, they're estimating about 350 plus in North America, a couple thousand in the world. That's like 10 years worth of manufacturing capacity for these giant transformers, which we have not made in the United States for the last decade or so. We've only made them offshore. People don't even know how to make them in this country, though. They're apparently getting one factory up and running to do it. So you're looking at a situation where if it happens like it's happened twice in the last 160 years, you're talking game over for our civilization and our society as we know it. And it will eventually put itself back together.
Matthew, we don't have a lot of time. Just go down a checklist of what is likely to happen if you woke up in the morning in the summer or winter and we had the big storm coming. What would happen? Go right down the checklist.
You'd go outside and at night you'd see blood red and orange and yellows and greens like you've never seen before in your life. And you'd say, wow, this is really something. And immediately the power and the lights would go down, the internet would go down, and you'd think, well, that's okay. You know, power outages happen before, they get everything going. Well, you know, the next day nothing would come on, the next day. Parts of the country might eventually, a week or two later, start to disconnect from the grid and restart themselves. But the heavily populated areas where most of us live would be so severely damaged that your sewer would fail, your internet would fail, the gas and power would fail, no money machines would work, you couldn't get money out of anywhere, you couldn't buy anything in the stores, no streetlights running, the whole infrastructure failing. Now imagine 50 Hurricane Katrinas happening at once, or 100 Hurricane Katrinas in this country, and imagine now that 6 to 8 months later they might start getting things limping along, stock market crashes, government crashes, people starving, chaos everywhere. And on top of that, the nuclear power plants would run out of backup fuel to keep their cooling systems going.
But that's 1 week. Hold on. You made two statements. We have to reconnect them. You said, and 8 or 10 months later, 1 week after this happens, all the fuel in all 104 nuclear power plants is gone. They're only now. They only have about a week.
Some of them have 30 days on store. Some of them have a week. I had some, after I announced, you know, they're mandated to have a week on hand, and so many of them will run out. A couple of power plant operators, you know, emailed me after I wrote the article, 400 Chernobyls, and they said, well, we have a month on hand. Okay, so some of them have a month, but I personally know an operator at a plant, and he says, no, we only have about a week.
Well, hold on. Matthew, still back up, please, 1 second. Not one single nuclear power plant in the United States has ever tested the 1 week or the 30-day with their backup generators. This is based upon a theoretical model. They've never actually had to run that for a week or a month with no other source of power to determine do these things actually work.
Well, they do start their generators up and test them now and then, and they actually have about a 3% failure rate when they do that.
But they're not running them for 30 days.
Right. They're just running them for, you know, half hour, an hour, and
that's
making
correct.
Sure everything, that they run right, that they can do the pumps and all of that. So, yeah, correct. Running these generators like 24-7 for 30 days or 6 months or a year until things are going, no, nobody has done that because they all assume that we have a nice, stable grid in the United States and that at worst it'll be down for a few days, and in general it's only down for a few hours.
What would happen to radio broadcasts, television broadcasts, cell phone communication, and internet?
you have about 3 hours of power for cell phone communications, 3 to 6 hours, and then the backup batteries are dead for cell phone communications. So cell phones actually go down first. You have about 3 days of power, backup power, for the central stations for your landline telephones, and then they go down. So after Hurricane Katrina, we saw, because it was such a widespread event, we saw a massive failure of the infrastructure, and it took months to get it going in certain areas. So, you know, cell phones down in a few hours, landlines down in a few days, 9/11 totally gone, gas, you know, natural gas mostly now requires electrical pumps to operate, so your natural gas will lose pressure and stop flowing unless they still have the old gas-powered pumps to compress the natural gas and keep it pumping in place. And they've mostly upgraded those to the new electric pumps, which means when the grid's down, then even your natural gas isn't flowing. So you're looking at a total cascading failure of all central services. So that means you're totally on your own. It's yo-yo time. You're on your own
No water, no food, no store's going to have anything. And if you don't have a capped-off gas in your car or van, with a backup,
right.
I'm suggesting a backup small trailer with 255 gallons always in storage that could get
right.
you a 30 miles, it could get you 3,000 miles, but if you don't get out of the city within 6 hours, you're not going to get out.
Yeah, and you know, when I recommend to people in my, I have a chapter in When Disaster Strikes on the Impian solar storms and a chapter on the unthinkable, surviving a nuclear catastrophe. And so I have a whole checklist of strategies. And basically, if you're trying to get out and you find yourself stuck in a traffic jam, then you go to sleep, you know, if you can, and don't waste your gas idling there and try to wake up in the middle of the night. And that might be your only chance to actually get out of town, get out of Dodge, is middle of the night when other people are sleeping. Use that time to get out. But it'll be tough, because think of the gridlock in a city like New York City when there's not a single functioning traffic light. And when people who don't have a full tank of gas start running out on the freeway and are just sitting there, and there's you certainly can't call a tow truck to come and help you out in that situation.
You can't call if you have a heart attack or stroke. You can't call an ambulance. If there's a crime, you can't call the police. How many of the police are going to stick around? Who's going to be coming around? Is it going to be FEMA? How are they going to come to your block? Will they ever come to your block? We ever know this? You know what I'd like
right.
to do,
and
Matthew?
How would you know if
you wouldn't
is
know.
Come?
And how would you know if an Indian Point blew a week later? How would you know?
You wouldn't have any clue if Indian Point all of a sudden became a Fukushima. And chances are that, you know, when you see an event like this, basically realize you have a week countdown to multiple Fukushima-like events in the country. And not necessarily everyone will go off, but many of them will.
But even if one does, Matthew, if they go off, there's no way to respond. Because
right, 37% of Americans live within 50 miles of a nuclear reactor. They build these things a little ways outside of major metro areas. They don't want them right in town, but they build them close because you have huge transmission losses if you're in, and that's dollars down the tube if they try to transmit that power a long ways. So they build them close to where they need the power. So you're looking at 37% of our population living within 50 miles of a nuclear power plant. And if a big situation, now how long, what's the chances? Here's the other scary thing. Statistically,
You know what? Hold on. I want you to hold your thoughts, and here's why. Because we're coming up to the end of this segment. If you are available Monday evening from 8 to 9 o'clock, following my normal 7 to 8 o'clock progressive commentary hour, I'd like for you to come on for an hour where you and I can talk about what you actually do if you're single, if you're old, if you have a family, if you don't have a car, if you do have a car, if you live in the suburbs of the city. What you need to do, where you need to go to help yourself, because we can't rush through it in a few seconds here. I'd like to set that aside for an hour. Are you available for an hour?
Yeah, sure. Let's
okay.
do it.
Then 8 p.m. Monday evening, Matthew Stein and I will share our cumulative knowledge, the articles we've written. I actually created a map of the United States. It's up on my website, to show people the 104 nuclear power facilities, so you're not going to go towards them. You'll go away from them, plus the best places to get to, what to have when you're there, how to prepare in advance. So this could be a very important discussion. You won't want to miss this. Be one of those situations where you decide not to make it important, and then something happens, and you think, uh-oh, what do I do? Well, you could have known what to do. You passed on it. So Progressive Commentary Hour, 8 p.m. My regular one starts at 7, which is also going to be powerful, on Monday evening. Matthew, I will look forward to continuing this conversation on Monday at 8 p.m.
Well, thank you, Gary. I look forward to that. And, you know, there will be time to react, but without pre-planning and having everything in place and actually knowing what to do, you'll be at a total loss, because there will be chaos. There will be every central service will be down and information will not be flowing. But there are some assumptions you can make just from looking at the sky and seeing what's happening.
Well, let's go over all that on Monday, okay, as we have to go now. Matthew Stein. And at that time, I'll be sharing with you the maps so you know where to go and where not to go, best places to go, how to get there, and how to plan in advance for the upcoming solar storms. We're just going to get hit with one tonight, but it'll be a minor one. It's 1.4. We're talking about the 25 to up, which can be absolutely a world changer. Let me mention that tomorrow I'm going to be up in Woodstock premiering War on Health, and at 7:30, a free showing at the Woodstock Community Center, 56 Rock City Road. Look forward to seeing you there. Sunday morning in the park for a natural living, running, walking club. Look forward to seeing you there. I'm also giving more of my clothes away. I brought over another bunch of shirts and pants and shoes today, so if you'd like, come by, and they're there as a gift. And we're also looking for some interns who would like to learn how to do documentary production, and you can call 646-926-5428. Let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, boy, I never have to worry about overeating during my lunch hour when I'm listening to the show. Nauseating when you hear this news. But just to add to that, though, once again in the news, something that you spoke about over 2 years ago, Gary, right in the New York Times. Spain's prime minister plans austerity steps in the form of coal subsidy cuts and a 21% sales tax. Madrid is Europe's fourth largest economy. You called this. You said Greece, Portugal, Ireland, Spain. They're facing interest rates for its bonds that are unsustainable in the long run. They're up to 25% unemployment, and there is chaos in the streets. I mean, it's bloody chaos.
Here's what the New York Times and the people in the mainstream media, the economists, refuse to acknowledge: the human equation. Because they've never been in that situation, unless they were a teenager or coming from a background. But if they are one of the best and brightest, as the reporters are, or as the economists are, and they got through Harvard and Yale based upon their families putting them there, they don't know what it's like. Let me give you what I would consider the actual scenario that we're going to see. I believe that within the next 3 months, the elected officials in Greece and Spain and in Italy, but starting in Greece, going to Spain, then Italy, will be thrown out of office. I believe that then they will come in and demand a cessation of all austerity programs. Why? Because right now in Spain, the European Central Bank, and along with the bondholders, have said, we're giving the banks the money first. So yeah, you're going to get $125 billion, but that goes just to the banks, not to the people. Then all the losses on this have to go to local bondholders, meaning local people who trusted their bank when they said, buy some bonds. It's good for the future. It's safe, and you'll get some return. They have to take the loss. But the big bondholders, the big investors in the European world and the Wall Street, they're protected. Then, to make sure that these people stay on their austerity program, charge them a 20% to 21% sales tax. Now, let me get this right. That's one of the highest sales tax in the world. Could you imagine if the average American today had to pay 21% in everything that they bought? It would just devastate the economy. Now you're taking people that we're going to take away minimum wage. We're going to fire upwards of 5%, 25% of all these workers. We're going to bust the bust the entitlements, and we're going to start selling all of the major assets in our country, which then are going to be privatized. So if your water's free, you're going to pay for it. If your highway driving down it is free, you're going to pay for it. If you're going to a lake, you're going to pay for it. Everything now you're going to have to pay for, but you're already strapped. In Spain, they actually had some very corrupt-minded people who passed laws that you cannot walk away from a mortgage. You can walk away or have it foreclosed on, you still have to pay it. So now you don't have the house, but you still got the debt. All this is because of the European Central Banks. And so how long do you think that the people of Spain and the people of Greece and the people of Ireland, and I know the people of Italy, once it hits the level where it's suddenly hitting them personally each day, they're going to rebel against this. So that's what I see happening. And then you're going to see them going off, repaying this debt. That's when you'll start to see that the entire myth of a single currency and a single economy was never sustainable. And the people will speak, and it will take anywhere from 3 to 6 months. But within 3 to 6 months, I predict you'll have social riots, the change of governments once or twice, until the people control their own destiny, and they will not acquiesce on any level to the bankers and to the to the people who don't care about them, like Merkel and some of the others. So that's how I see it going. Let's see if I'm right. Hope I'm wrong, but that's what I see. And it's time for the people to stand up. Will that happen in the United States? Not at all. And I'll tell you why. We will not have protest. We will not have riots. We will not have anti-government movements. We will not have the anti-constitutionalists or the Greens or anyone else really joining and fighting the government. A real authentic look, not always uplifting, but honest, next week in a commentary I wrote last night about why we do not have the heart, the will, the brains, or the courage to fight about anything in the United States when it comes to the masses. Individuals, small groups, progressives, yes. But as a country, no. And I'll tell you why. Thank you, Luann, for calling in. And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Nall. Look forward to sharing more Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Talkback, all about health for an hour. And now, Danny Schechter. I believe he's back from... No, he's not back, but he's in South Africa, and he'll be back. And I'm going to take 60 seconds and come back and help WBAI for the next hour. Raise some funds. Got to run up to my desk now. Thank you for listening.